This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehayus Wahib in Washington. Here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
I have personally seen the great work done by local artisans producing everything from office furniture to building fixtures. And yet the young people who do such great work are never given a chance. I'm here to change all that.
That was Malawi President Lazarus Chakwera banning government departments from importing goods and services which can be locally made or found. Details coming up also. Islamic State claims responsibility for the attack on Palma, a town in Mozambique. And Zimbabwe's economy, already in bad shape, is getting worse because of the COVID lockdowns. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Details are emerging of the weekend attack on the town of Palma in Mozambique's war-torn Cabo Delgado province. On Monday, the Islamic State claimed the responsibility for the attack, which took place shortly after French fossil fuel company Total began restarting its natural gas projects in the region. Dozens are feared dead, including at a hotel where many foreign workers sought refuge amid an international rescue effort. VOA's Jason Patinkin spoke to journalist Tom Boker, who edits the Mozambique-focused Zitamar News website.
The town is divided between the insurgents and government forces. Some Mozambican media were taken up to Cabo Delgado and flown over Palma yesterday in helicopters by the Mozambican military. And they were been told by the military that the military have half the town under control. The government claiming they're on their way to liberating it, but I'm a bit more skeptical because it could be that the insurgents are just hanging on to the bits they want to hang on to, and they could be a long time before they're dislodged.
And what's the latest word on casualties from the fighting?
Probably the most recent estimate from anyone was the Islamic State claim that they'd killed 55 people, which, to be honest, given some of the reports and guesstimates from people who'd spoken to eyewitnesses coming out of there, I was surprised that was so low and relieved, obviously, that, I mean, it's still a terrible death toll, but I guess it seems now that the death toll is probably in the tens rather than the hundreds. The Mozambique government also said tens. People had suggested that in the ambush on the convoy that fled the Amarula Hotel, that even 50 people had died just in that one event. So if you then add that to the civilians and refugees living in Palma who were, according to some accounts, slaughtered at the beginning of the attack, you know, it sounded like we were going to be looking at easily a triple figures death toll, but perhaps not.
The Amarula Hotel, that's where a lot of foreigners associated with the Total gas project were located, and there was an attempt to evacuate them. Is there any word, not just on foreigners, but for all residents, on evacuations from Pemba?
Some people are being evacuated by air. So DAG, the mercenary helicopter operation, say that they have been picking up people in helicopters, taking them to the airstrip at Afungi, which serves the Total project. And from there, they are largely being flown down to Maputo. The South African government put on a plane to fly people back to South Africa from Afungi. But also there are boats, large boats, as well as smaller dhows, taking people down to Pemba, the provincial capital. One boat, I think, had some about 1,300 people on it, a mixture of, you know, migrant workers working on the project, some of whom are foreign. I think easily the majority are Mozambicans as well, probably from elsewhere in Mozambique, but also locals fleeing Palma, some of which have fled previously to Palma from elsewhere, thinking that Palma might be safe. Turns out it was wrong. The UN said in a report they released yesterday that Palma was home to 43,600 displaced people from elsewhere in the province who'd sought safety in Palma.
And is there any indication of displacement from this latest attack? You mentioned thousands were already displaced to Palma. Could it be that thousands more are now displaced again.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think a lot of people have fled north towards Tanzania. That's in the hundreds at least. I don't know if it reaches 1,000, but up to 500, I think, apparently at the border settlement of Namoto. People have fled inland. People have walked up to 100 kilometers to Nangad, which is a town on the way to Mueda, and the people of Nangad are now concerned that they're the insurgents' next target.
That was journalist Tom Boker, who edits the Mozambique-focused Zitamar News website, speaking with VOA's Jason Patenkin. Many experts say the world should prepare for another pandemic due to factors like climate change, loss of wildlife habitat, antibiotic resistance, the ability to mutate quickly, and sheer bad luck. One man who has thought deeply on the subject is Thomas J. Boyke, the Senior Fellow for Global Health, Economics and Development at the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington, and the co-director of its independent task force on preparing for the next pandemic. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips, praising the stellar role that science has played in dealing with the current crisis. Indeed, China identified the genetic sequence of the virus within 5 days.
One part of the global response to this pandemic that went well was the science.
I remember the genetic sequence of the virus was published by China within 5 days.
And we were already had identified vaccine candidates, and within 66 days, they were already into clinical trials. And we developed the first effective vaccine against this virus within 10 months. The previous record had been 4 years. But despite how quickly we developed that vaccine and how quickly we ramped up production, we still suffered $20 trillion in economic losses and more than 3 million deaths globally.
How can we avoid those sorts of catastrophic numbers in the future?
Part of that is health systems that can protect people and also contain this virus better and be able to identify its emergence. And part of it is accelerating effective vaccines and treatments even more than what we saw in this crisis.
What other improved strategies can you recommend moving forward?
The first is around surveillance. We can no longer depend on the reporting and transparency of the directly affected country to learn about an outbreak. In every major epidemic we have seen, the directly affected country was late in reporting. So we recommend a hospital-based sentinel surveillance network, voluntary, anonymous data that at least can keep track week in and week out. That would have made a difference in this case, where at a minimum, the virus started to emerge in early December and nobody knew about it globally until the beginning of January. And about that point, it had spread. So we need to be able to identify outbreaks earlier. The second thing is that we've seen very little progress on global cooperation on addressing this pandemic. There should be, for interested governments, an opportunity to work together on all the non-health aspects of a pandemic. So sharing medicines, making sure we're not taking trade measures that make it harder to get supplies of masks and other personal protective equipment out of countries, having more coordination on economic relief, all the things that happen in a pandemic that aren't just about health.
What's the third element your task force recommends when contemplating a future pandemic?
We need a architecture to support R&D so that we can develop vaccines and therapeutics, diagnostics even faster, but also get them on a more equitable basis to the world sooner. People refer to this as a once-in-a-100-year pandemic, but the next pandemic threat could be emerging next year, next month, even today. New viruses emerge all the time, and we have to be better prepared than we were in this crisis.
There are many subtle but powerfully integrated elements to consider when trying to prevent or mitigate a future pandemic. An environmental approach is certainly one.
Moving forward, we really do need to take what they refer to as a one world health approach to preparing and responding to pandemics. We can't just focus on what can keep our country safe once a pandemic emerges elsewhere. We have to restrain the practices, whether they be agricultural or development, that contribute to the emergence of these new viruses to begin with. And one really good example of that is, of course, bushmeat, wildlife markets. Really need to think more holistically about where the threats might come from in the future, and some of that may be on the treatment of wildlife.
That was Thomas J. Boyke, the Senior Fellow for Global Health, Economics and Development at the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington, speaking with VOA's Adam Phillips. After a long wait, the Tunisian parliament ratified recent revisions of the draft bill for the Constitutional Court. A session would be held on 18th April to complete the elections for members of the Constitutional Court. Establishing a Tunisian constitutional court earlier could have enabled Tunisia to avoid the latest political crisis stemming from a power struggle between its president and his prime minister. Mongid Haoudi, a Tunisian-American political analyst, discussed these developments with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
I think having a constitutional court definitely would resolve some of these crises and at least give a chance for a government to proceed, whether with the current reshuffle or to give the president the right to refuse them. Therefore, the government has to either submit its resignation or seek a different kind of changes. What's preventing forming the constitutional court is basically the current electoral law that we have has produced a very fragmented parliament. It might have worked well after the first election when we needed to write a constitution where all Tunisians needed to see themselves in and would reflect the diversity of the Tunisian people and their backgrounds. But right now, this election and rules and regulations produce a very fragmented scene where it is extremely difficult to get the parliament to agree with two-third majority on the constitutional court. And so what ended up happening, the parliament has passed or changed some of these rules and dropped the requirement to three-fifths. So that means reducing the number of the needed votes to establish the court and appoint their quotas of judges. They dropped the requirement by about 14 votes. And I think that might be the magic trick that would enable Tunisia to finally establish a constitutional court and hopefully have a chance at resolving this latest crisis.
So how did the division in Tunisian parliament contribute to the delay of establishing the constitutional court?
It is extremely difficult because the current system allows the parliament to appoint four judges to this court and the president to appoint four and this consortium of the judges to appoint the other four. So therefore, we have a complete 12-member constitutional court. But because the parliament could not agree, could not have a two-third majority that would agree on these names and appoint the four judges, we couldn't move on with the whole process. And so they dropped the requirement. So we don't need two-thirds of the parliament. We only need three-fifths of votes, which comes to about 130. And that would open. And also they asked the president and the judges, the rest of the judges, to go ahead and appoint their four. So therefore, kind of speeding up this process. And so hopefully this will happen and hopefully we'll have a court within a few months.
That was Mongid Haoudi, a Tunisian-American political analyst, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi. Malawi President Lazarus Chakwera has banned government departments from importing goods and services which can be locally made or found in a televised national address, Chakwera said. The measure is aimed to economically uplift local companies who have lost businesses due to COVID-19. However, economists question whether the locally made goods will meet the needs standards. Lamek Messina reports from Blantyre.
The directive Sunday night came 3 months after the government proposed new guidelines on its procurement of goods, works and services. Chakwera said there is no justification for importing things like uniforms and shoes for army and police officers while suffering local businesses can offer such goods.
I'm directing all MDAs to give preference to the procurement of locally made goods. I have personally seen the great work done by local artisans producing everything from office furniture to building fixtures. And yet the young people who do such great work are never given a chance. I'm here to change all that.
Chakwera urged the Office of the Registrar of Companies to assist prospective suppliers of goods and services from the informal sector with speedy registration. He warned those who ignore the directive.
I'm putting all public servants on notice regarding these policies because any MDA found to not be adhering to this will be answerable and bear the consequences of their failure.
Some critics question whether the quality and quantity of locally made goods will meet the needed standards. But Bichani Cheleni, a lecturer in economics at Polytechnic, a constituent college of the University of Malawi, welcomes the directive. But he says agencies need to help build the capacity of those wishing to supply locally made goods and services.
Such as the Malawi Bureau of Standards to come to the party, they should not be there as punitive agencies. They should be there as agencies which are going to help in the improvement of the products. If some Malawian is not doing things according to the standards, send them for training, help them, show them how to do it.
Despite the COVID-related challenges, Chakwera said Malawi's economic outlook for 2021 remains positive with a GDP growth rate of 3.8%.
Although headline inflation recorded an uptick to 8.3% last month, which is consistent with the nature of the transition we are in, it remains within the desired trajectory towards achieving a medium to long-term inflation rate target of 5%.
He says the opening of agriculture marketing season in April will help bolster the supply of foreign exchange, mainly from Tobago, the country's main foreign exchange earner. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blanta.
The West Africa Civil Society Institute says the coronavirus pandemic has greatly affected the region, especially in getting technological equipment to help them work remotely. Mavis Ochera in Juwaso in the Ashanti region of Ghana has more.
The Institute WASI, with support from TechSoup, is seeking to support civil society organizations to break technology gaps through its hardware donation initiative. It has started a donation of 102 laptops to 40 organizations from 7 countries, including Benin, Ghana, Nigeria, Liberia, Cameroon, Sierra Leone, and the Gambia. Jim Chick from Angel, head of knowledge management and communications at the Cameroon-based institute, says when the pandemic struck, his organization initiated research to better understand how civil society organizations were affected by the pandemic and the best way to cushion the impact on their work. He says 400 organizations across 6 countries partook in the survey. WASI then partnered with TechSoup to implement the program. He says many had to work from home or meet virtually, but most were handicapped not knowing how to do that and operate efficiently.
The challenges were real. Challenges with regards to funding, challenges with regards to technology. You know, many organizations were now diving into online engagements, you know, attending meetings on Skype, on Zoom. And for example, some of us, you know, even being introduced to Zoom, we did not have the adequate gadgets that could support this, be they laptops, desktops, and why not phones. So in a way, many of our organizations were seriously affected by COVID.
Fomenjo says five civil organizations in Cameroon have been provided with 6 laptops, noting that his institute would have needed about 1,000 to fill all the requests, reflecting how technology has become an indispensable tool. Emmanuel Wisi is director of Cameroon Gender and Environment Watch, which works to protect the interests of women and children and protect the environment. He says his organization has planted 87,000 trees in the Kilimanjaro forest and undertakes environmental education to change the behavior, especially of the older generation, towards the forest.
We are so excited to receive this kind of equipment. But I think this was another way of giving back to communities and giving back to organizations, which our organization appreciated so much.
He says sharing resources like internet service, laptops, and printers from home is a challenge.
All this used to be shared. But now when we came with the issue of working from a distance, these services have become difficult to be shared. And again, not all the staff are able to work as a team. They are still be self-reliant. Most of them cannot be work on their own. They need supervision.
Wisi says access to more laptops would as related staff work. Reporting for VOA, this is Mavis Autry in Jassu in the Ashanti region of Ghana.
With Zimbabwe's economy already in bad shape, COVID-19 has sent the cost of living up and the value of the US dollar down. Lockdowns to stem the spread of the coronavirus have forced most people to stay home, robbing them of their incomes and savings. Teachers and other civil servants are demanding pay raises, saying inflation has eroded their salaries and they cannot afford to work. Now the government has approved higher university fees, putting education out of reach to many and clouding their future. Reporter Kuzaza Nwashi has the details.
Tapio Anashe Chiriga is the Secretary General of the Zimbabwe National Students Union, or ZINASU. He says increases in fees at state tertiary institutions have been brutal.
Nationally, we were paying fees ranging from 9,000 RTGS dollars to at least 14,000 RTGS, which is something around 90 US dollars to 150 US dollars. Now, fees have been hiked from that amount to around 35,000 to 45,000. That is the national range from what we have seen.
Chiriga says the hikes are not justified.
Minister Murira needs to keep his word that there was never going to be fees hikes in 2021. There is surely no justification for fees hikes when students are learning from home buying their own data. What is said is that these hikes come when students are attending lectures over WhatsApp and in some instances not even learning at all, just waiting for exams.
Sicelo Ncube is a student at the University of Zimbabwe. She says the hikes put her in a fix.
As a daughter of a teacher, of a government employee, and with her salary, it won't be enough to pay my fees all in once. It's really hard. Unless government then adds more money to her salary to make it a little bit better, I'd have to quit school or my mom takes another bank loan.
The Minister of Higher and Tertiary Education has not been answering calls seeking comment. But Deputy Minister Raymond Machingura defended the hikes recently. He told Parliament the fees include tuition and upkeep and maintenance of the school. So, if fuel, food, and data go up, as they have been, the fees have to rise to cover costs. What's worse, Chiriga says, like Ncube, this move makes education inaccessible to many.
The government of Zimbabwe, through Amon Murira, is not only seeking to widen the schism between the poor and the rich, they have demonstrated every intention to shut out the majority of the students out of school and deprive them of the right to accessible and affordable education. In the present economic circumstances, we can as well kiss education goodbye.
Critics worry the hikes are not aligned with the incomes of many, who will struggle even more to make ends meet. Critics say it will not be surprising to see some students drop out temporarily or for good. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zvinavashe from Harare.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.